I'm Megan.
This is Josh.
Good evening. It's a lot of fun to be here. Megan and I and Danielle, or excuse me, Judge Gibbons, went to law school together. I'm still getting used to that. And it's always so much fun to come down here and talk about ethics, attorney competency, and pop culture is always a great way to explore that and to see examples of what to do and what not to do. I coached high school mock trial for over 5 years, and I've organized mock trials at different Comic-Cons, so this is something that I enjoy doing, so we have a lot of material on best practices from Tom Malway and other thought leaders on trial practice.
And I promise this will not be like the last one we did last year, all on Marvel. Well, all of you guys looked at me like you had no idea what I was talking about. I promise you will at least be able to relate to some of this.
It's only pop culture. So let's take a look at some of the fun issues. Okay, so. Nope, 1 second.
Okay.
Nope, next slide.
I'm just doing it. I did it.
Okay. So, Chris Scott Graham, great attorney, practices up in the Bay Area, a McGeorge grad, and wrote a wonderful book on strategies and for trial attorneys. And love that quote that he has from his book, The Way of the Lawyer. And you know, it sums up a lot of what we have to do as attorneys. And the next slide is from one of my favorite judges, wears a bow tie, recently retired. He is one of the e-discovery thought leaders in the country, and Judge Fasciola. And it's so true, the idea that watching an incompetent lawyer is like watching a clumsy ballerina, I think sums up what bad trial experience looks like. So let's get into some of the ethical duties that we have to the court when we're in court. So there are three big elements to the duty of candor that we're going to jump into right now. Go for it.
Okay, so first one, duty of, you're taller than me. So rule 3.31, candor towards the tribunal, is that a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement or fact or law to a tribunal or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by a lawyer.
Next up.
Is your thing working?
It should be now.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Next up is a lawyer shall not fail to disclose legal authority that could be counter to their case. Again, be truthful. You can't ignore bad law. So just one of those little things of this is how we practice. There's no surprise anymore. We don't have Perry Mason moments. And of course, part 3 to the code. Oh, it worked in practice.
Oh, well, fine. I'll do it.
Okay. All right.
All right. So obviously a lawyer shall not offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. So don't, if you know your client's going to lie on the stand, don't put them on there. So, you know.
There's a caveat with criminal defendants, but yeah, you just let them talk. Don't put false evidence out there. And we'll talk about that with some of the examples that we have. Next up, why closing arguments matter. And there's just, this is so simple and direct. This is your, oh, go on.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is your last chance with the attorney, or with the jury. This is, ideally they like you. Ideally they like your client. You've told them your story. The reason that the facts are for your client. The law is for your client.
And for trial lawyers, this is the holy grail. This is like the best part of the trial is to do your closing argument. So everybody knows that. Like you are amped to do your closing argument. Oh, sorry.
It's okay. So I'm a proponent of write your closing argument first.
That's a good thought. Not everyone does that.
Now, I might lean towards the plaintiff side of the bar, which makes our friendship exciting when we talk about things. You know, from a plaintiff point of view, you have the jury instructions. You have to prove your case. That's why we're here. And the jury instructions are your friends in being able to say, this is what the law is, this is what happened, This is why my client is in the right. And if you're not doing that, you're missing the point. The other part of this is the law. You have to connect the law to the facts. The jurors are lay people 99.9% of the time. Not everyone's going to get a lawyer on the jury. And speaking of someone who got booted off a jury because they saw the bow tie and went, oh God, he's a lawyer. You want them to understand to connect the dots, and the jury instructions and the laws are the best way to do that.
Now, as a defense attorney, I don't write my closing argument first. I've never written my closing argument first. I either write it the night before or while plaintiff is giving their closing argument, because I can take parts of their closing argument and throw it into mine, like their theme and stuff like that. But it is helpful, I'm sure, if I had more time and I prepared way more for trials than I do now, that I would might write my closing argument first. That might be helpful. But, you know.
So, think of lawyers as storytellers. We are telling a story about why the facts favor our client, why the law says our client is right. Think of the reason that the number of attorneys who end up writing books, it's because we tell stories, because we have a story to tell, and it's what we do.
So,
here's what lawyers should do in a perfect world. Know the law. Seems counterintuitive, but you should. Know your judge. What does your judge like? What does your judge dislike? Do not upset the judge. Pro tip. Think of themes that you have that tell your story, that relate to the jurors, topics that they understand. So when they go into the jury room, they think, yes, this client, this party is the one who was wronged and we have to make this right. Understand tools of persuasion. We live in a world where we have tons of cable channels that have documentaries on it, all with computer animated scenes explaining how ships sank or how airplanes fly. Jurors want to know how stuff works. And if you're just going up there with sock puppets to explain the facts, that's not enough. One of the most important things that I learned in law school was that jurors forget 2/3 of what they hear. And what they do remember is usually wrong. But if you use a visual aid, retention goes up 80%. That's important if you're dealing with someone's old life. It's important if you're dealing with millions of dollars or you have a small business. No one I know can take a $150,000 hit and still go on with a normal life. So being able to explain this is the law matters. Even way back in 1999, there were judges in Sacramento, California requiring all jury instructions to be on PowerPoints, because they wanted the jurors to understand what the case was about. So the content of a closing argument is, start with the jury instructions if you're the plaintiff. It's handy if you're the defendant, so you know what you have to knock down. Remember, you have to use admitted evidence. That's why starting with the jury instructions and writing your closing is helpful, because you know what you need to get in. There's always the age-old argue reasonable inferences, because we're big fans of the answer, it depends. And use exhibits, being able to piece the story together. And there are wonderful tips on exhibits of 10 is a good number in a normal size case, 20 in a complicated one. If you're dealing in the world of electronically stored information, going in with 20,000 emails is not a good plan, because everyone will melt and the court reporter will start crying. So let's talk about improper closing arguments. And Megan, why don't you take lead on this one?
Okay, so there's 2 inches too tall for me here. All right, so there's several things that you can do, and I'm sure that we've all done this at one point, but there's several things that, according to the ethics rules, are improper in closing arguments. So, mentioning unadmitted evidence, misstating evidence, improperly commenting on evidence, stating personal opinions, which we will get to examples of, and I promise you there are a lot of them, appealing to juror sympathy, prejudice, or self-interest, also a lot of those. And that goes with requesting the jurors to place themselves in the plaintiff's shoes. Now, there's a thing for civil lawyers that we deal with a lot called the reptile theory. So part of the golden rule argument is, actually, here's my notes, sorry, wrong thing. So the golden rule is that everyone should treat others as you wish to be treated. That's always the golden rule, and you're not supposed to argue that. Part of the golden rule, and like a subcategory, is to put the juror into the plaintiff's shoes or the defendant's shoes. But the other subcategory is now the reptile theory for civil lawyers. And the reptile theory has become a huge deal. So basically, they suggest that, I'm just going to read this to you because they have the power to improve the safety of themselves, their family members, and their community by rendering a verdict that will reduce or eliminate dangerous conduct such as that alleged against the plaintiff or defendant. So the trial tactic is to appeal to the juror's ability to make the world a safer place and is being taught in plaintiff's advocacy trial courses and at MCLEs and everything. I've already been to like several of them where they teach this. For example, and this made me giggle earlier today, so I'm going to read it to you because it's funny. Here's an example. One of the ways to do so is to spread the tentacles of danger. So here's an example of that. Doctor, my expert, not everyone has the experience with childbirth. Could you please explain how violating the rule that defendant violated in the delivery room is a dangerous way to practice medicine? Expert says, well, let me explain by using the example of an older person reporting chest pains to the emergency room staff. Then have the expert provide examples of how the rule works in additional areas of medicine. That makes the danger a community danger rather than just a danger to babies and mothers during childbirth. Or, for another example, Mr. Driver's Ed teacher, the defense told the jury that a low-speed crash can't cause serious harm. What do you teach your students about that? Answer, I show them the state statistics of how many people in cars are permanently injured every year in collisions at speeds under 12 miles an hour. My driver's ed teacher never did that. And I explain that the same impact could easily maim or kill pedestrians as it does all the time. That way it helps show low-speed collisions cause harm to people in cars and everyone is at a lethal risk from a low-speed, less than 5 miles an hour impact. So this is the reptile theory that civil attorneys deal with a lot. It comes up in anything, if you have anything with Carpenter and Zuckerman, it comes up every time. But just letting you know.
Why is it the reptile theory?
Would you want, okay, so I was wondering if somebody was going to ask me that. And I didn't want to like bore everybody with this, but I will totally tell you. No, I will totally read it to you. Because the reptile theory, so... what you have to do is, let me get to the part where it is. It is the reptilian part of the brain, which my colleagues and I simply and affectionately call the reptile, runs our automatic life functions. An arbitrarily chose pronoun, creates, directs, and motivates our survival, drives, and hunger, sex, and danger avoidance. She has no emotion or thought or memory, but enlists those services from other parts of the brain to fight for you and your gene's survival chances. Whenever anything can potentially affect those chances or survival, even if they're little, this most primitive thing in your head grabs full control of your entire brain and includes control of your logical, emotional, and other decision-making resources. So that's what they use. They say that if you're going to save the community, this small little part in your brain is going to take over and have you rule for them because you're going to be saving the community. So this comes up a lot in civil cases. A lot. So continue. Oh, I'm sorry. We had other things, which are improperly arguing the law, back to our slide, arguing consequences of the verdict, which Danielle taught me about, and I did not know you were allowed to do that. Judge Gibbons said that you're not allowed to argue the consequences of the verdict during a criminal trial. Did not know that. Improperly arguing on rebuttal, referring to verdicts of other juries, referring to judgments in similar cases, and expressing a personal belief in the credibility of a witness.
Which brings us to what we have to do, and that's paint a picture for the jury so they understand what happened. It's really easy for lawyers who've spent months doing document review. They've lived with the very passionate client who's upset about what happened to them. And in those cases, you might feel the need to just say everything at once. And then you get a giant blob. And you expect the jurors to understand what that blob is. And that's just not how we should argue. Take the time to paint the picture so the jurors understand exactly what happened. Now, there are a bunch of theories on how to put together a closing argument. One of the ways that I like to do it, or have advised those to do it, is the impact beginning. Why are we here? It quickly captures the attention of the jurors and everyone in the courtroom. You know, it could be recreating the events. It's starting with the themes that connect the jurors to the emotion of the situation. You're hitting them with the dramatic evidence because that's what they remember. You then explain everything that you need to explain, and you paint a very strong picture. Because you want to avoid the danger of the chronology method is very popular and normal, but you have to not say, in the beginning, there was darkness. Get to the point. Tell the story so everyone understands what happened. Other themes that we have to think about when looking at the evidence and preparing your case is, what am I going to argue? Again, can't do everything at once. Figure out what's key and what evidence connects to that point of law that you want to argue. Using the jury instructions and law is, again, pivotal to this. Acknowledge what is the weakest part of your case and figure out how to address that. Are there concerns that the judge has? Again, if you have a judge who doesn't like insurance companies or whatever, be ready for that and think about how to respond. Speaking the truth. Figure out what's the emotional core of the case and being able to connect that, because when you think about it, cases are about people. Yeah, it could be a big company, but it's still about the human beings. And you want to go with the evidence that tells the story the most effectively. Case in point, our old civil pro professor worked on one of the savings and loan cases. And they had all of this great math that showed millions of dollars going crazy. And they opted not to use that math because the little evidence showing somebody taking a trip to Europe with the money that was a much smaller amount had greater sex appeal for the jurors to understand something nefarious had happened. So think in those terms. And the other big point is, make a point. Don't just say, here's everything that bad that happened to me from this individual. What's the point? Start with the point.
Also, don't repeat your whole trial.
Common sense is a big thing. You know, we have that reasonably prudent person standard for a reason. Embrace it.
I like to tell jurors at the end of my closing, look, you didn't drop your common sense at the door. So, use your common sense in here. So, all right.
People understand stories and analogies. And again, there are some that you're not supposed to do, and we'll see a little bit of that with the pop culture examples, but human beings relate to stories, to an analogy, and there are a lot that you can use. And the big thing is, connect with the jurors, and that's engage with them and good body language, eye contact. You have experience with this.
Don't sit, and I didn't do this, but don't stand behind the podium. You're not the president. You don't need to do this or this. Like, move around. They want to see you if you're just standing there. Or I had in my last trial in December, I had an attorney, co-defense counsel, he basically repeated the entire trial in his closing argument. He had so many notes, they were falling off the podium. So if you're just succinct, you know, and make eye contact, move around, just, you know, make it enjoyable.
Don't tap dance, but on the flip side, don't lock your knees so you pass out. That is bad form. Use a vocabulary that's easy to understand. Clear sentence structure. Speak to jurors in a way that they understand what you're talking about. This isn't the time to show off that I'm the smartest person in the room. I aced the SATs, and I'm going to use every big word that I can think of, because not everyone respects that. They can feel that you're talking down to them. And then, of course, let's talk about the problems in closing. Don't be boring. Having a weak opening or a weak first minute of your closing could be fatal. Not arguing, not asking for relief, not using visual aids, not using the evidence. All of that is fatal to your argument.
I was just listening to a book, and in the prologue she mentioned that we're in the CSI age, so jurors want visuals. Even though I don't do criminal, and so I have no idea what's going on there, but jurors want visuals. They want to see stuff. They don't just talk to them. They want to see things. So
there are other dangers that you can have in giving your closing argument, and you have too much law. This isn't law review article time. You know, you have a weak ending. It's like, whatever. You're disorganized. You're reading off a clipboard terrified. You have no passion, or you have too much emotion, all of which is bad.
So this is a true story. I had a case a couple years ago when I was working for State Farm, and the plaintiff attorney, this is a low impact, less than 10 miles an hour rear end accident. The plaintiff's attorney, whose name I will not say, cried during his closing, saying that he just loved his client so much, and he really cried. And I had to reach over to my client and say, don't move, don't say anything, just look down. And I was like, oh my God, did he cry? And the foreman of the jury, after a four-minute defense verdict, came out and told that plaintiff's attorney, don't ever do that again. That was the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Why would you cry? Like, he was too much emotion. Your crocodile tears are not working here. So, all right.
So let's get into the clips.
You guys are going to love these. I'm very excited about these. Okay.
I'm here to apologize. I am young and I am inexperienced. But you cannot hold Carl Lee Haley responsible for my shortcomings. You see, in all this legal maneuvering, something has gotten lost. And that something is the truth. Now, it is incumbent upon us lawyers not to just talk about the truth, but to actually seek it, to find it, to live it. Let's take Dr. Bass, for example. Now, obviously, I would have never knowingly put a convicted felon on the stand. I hope you can't believe that. But what is the truth? That he's a disgraced liar? And what if I told you that the woman he was accused of raping was 17, he was 23, that she later became his wife, bore his child, and still married to the man today? Does that make his testimony more or less true? What is it in us that seeks the truth? Is it our minds? Or is it our hearts? I set out to prove a black man could receive a fair trial in the South, that we are all equal in the eyes of the law. That's not the truth. Because the eyes of the law are human eyes, yours and mine, and until we can see each other as equals, justice is never going to be even-handed. It will remain nothing more than a reflection of our own prejudices. So until that day, we have a duty under God to seek the truth. Not with our eyes, and not with our minds, with fear and hate and commonality into prejudice, but with our hearts. I want to tell you a story. I'm going to ask you all to close your eyes. This is a story about a little girl walking home from the grocery store on a sunny afternoon. I want you to picture this little girl. Suddenly a truck races up. Two men jump out and grab her. Drag her into a nearby field. And they tie her up. And they rip her clothes from her body. Now they climb on. First one, then the other. Raping. Shattering everything innocent and pure. Vicious thrust. The fog of drunken breath and sweat. When they're done, after they killed their tiny wound, murdered any chance for her to bear children, to have life beyond her own, they decided to use it for target practice. They start throwing full beer cans at her. Throwing so hard, tears her flesh all the way to her bones, and they urinate on her. Nothing's hanging. They have a rope, tie a noose. Imagine the noose coiling tied around your neck. A sudden blinding jerk. It's pulled into the air and the feet and legs go kicking. They don't find the ground. The hanging branch isn't strong enough. It snaps and she falls back to the earth. They pick her up, throw in the back of the truck, drive out to Foggy Creek Bridge, pitch her over the edge. I want you to picture a little girl now. Imagine she's white.
Okay, so first of all, I realize that the clips that you're going to be watching from now on are kind of done in a vacuum. So we're only watching the closing arguments. We don't know what's going on, unless you've seen the movie, through the rest of the movie. So there's a lot of stuff you're going to see in the closing argument that we're making assumptions about. Now, to get the seven clips, I want you to see, like, I went through at least 30 movies to get, like, seven clips of closing arguments. It was a project. Now, for A Time to Kill, I've done a ton of research on this, just closing arguments and ethics and closing arguments, and A Time to Kill was probably the number one most moving and effective closing argument that was used throughout the country. However, who sees problems with these? With this? Anybody? Anybody? Judge Bernal.
First, the evidence that he brought in.
Correct. Yes, definitely. Anybody else? Yes?
What about, since he was representing the defendant, what's the self-defense and the elements that he may have to prove? The prosecution didn't meet them.
Correct. He didn't say any of that. Anybody else? Anybody? So he also...
He didn't say so, but he put the jury in
Exactly. That is exactly what he did. That he did the golden rule, which you're not supposed to do, which is he placed the jurors in the shoes of the plaintiff, which I will tell you, that closing argument, it gives me chills every time. It's super moving, but it's apparently very wrong. you're just inflaming the passion and the prejudice of the jury through the whole thing. So he also talks about a personal opinion on culpability about, I would never place a convicted felon on the stand. Not supposed to really talk about that either. So those are some of the issues with it. But that and another one that we get to later are the two like most talked about closing arguments in movies. So these are other ones. The next one, I believe Judge Gibbons will find this amusing. Or any criminal defense attorney.
Ms. Gamble talked about our system, rights of defendants and victims. You know that 90-something percent of all defendants are guilty? Think about it. By the time they get to trial, they've been judged guilty many times. You got the accuser and the arresting officers, the detectives and a grand jury, then probable cause. We got all these mini steps along the way, each of them concluding the same thing. The guy did it. And since the facts, you see, DAs, they just want to give a good, accurate presentation of the facts. But defense lawyers, our job is to skew them. We stand up to distort, bend, hide the truth if necessary. And if you got a guilty guy, which we usually do, what? We're going to hope the jury gets the right idea? My craft, smoke and mirrors, deceit. Criminal defense attorneys aren't about searching for the truth. Are you kidding?
Mr. Donald.
That's our system. The DA has to prove guilt beyond all reasonable doubt, and defense lawyers spews doubt whenever, wherever, with all the discipline that perverted bastard probably spews semen on his wall.
Counsel,
I'd like to finish my closing argument. This man, I think he's guilty. I'm sure as hell not supposed to say that, but I think he did it. The problem is, I can't be sure. Neither can you. Because all we have is one witness. Sympathetic, definitely. Compelling, no doubt. But credible? His own mother waited 2 days to call the police because even she didn't believe him at first. He has a history of leveling false accusations, a history of lying and cheating, a track record of crying out for attention, a history of drug use. The story itself changed with different statements to the police. On the possibility that Mitchell Orbis really did commit these crimes, I hope he goes away. But in this country, we don't take away a man's freedom on the possibility of guilt or likelihood, even an overwhelmingly strong likelihood. You have to find guilt beyond all reasonable doubt. And I'm sorry, you can't get there with one lone witness, especially one whose word lacks credibility. My client may be scum, but there is no real case against him in this courtroom today, which means the heroes here have to be you. You have to go back to that room, uphold your oath to our system, because if you don't, God forbid the day comes when the only thing standing between our freedom and prison cell is the accusing finger from a child who lies. Because that's all we have here today, ladies and gentlemen. One accusing finger from a child who's been known to lie.
So, how many criminal defense attorneys are here?
Or former criminal defense attorneys? See any problems with that? Well, I will say he had a theme and he stuck with it. Any issues that you saw besides the fact that he called his own client scum and guilty? He also ignored the judge who told him to stop. He's like, nope, let me finish. Yep, misstates law. And he also breached his duty of loyalty. Ooh, cookies. I'm a sucker for a cookie. He also breached his loyalty to his client. This just makes me laugh because Josh and I were watching it. Like, there's so many things wrong with it. I don't even know if we can even list them all. There's just so many things wrong with it. And now I see why Judge Gibbons cannot watch Law & Order or any kind of judge shows or lawyer shows. I see that now. All right. Okay, so the next one, some of you may or may not have seen.
The verdict. And this is the closing.
Mr. Gallo, the nation.
You know, so much of the time we're just lost. Say, please, God, tell us what is right, tell us what is true. Justice. The rich win, the poor are powerless. We become tired of hearing people lie. And after a time we become dead. A little dead. We think of ourselves as victims. And we become victims. We become weak. We doubt ourselves, we doubt our beliefs. We doubt our institutions. And we doubt the law. For today, you are the law. You are the law. Not some book. Not the lawyers, not a marble statue, or the trappings of the court. See, those are just symbols of our desire to be just. They are in fact a prayer, a fervent and a frightened prayer. In my religion, they say, act as if you had faith. Faith will be given to you. If we are to have faith in justice, we need only to believe in ourselves and act with justice. I believe there is justice in our hearts.
So, cinematography is amazing. One take from up high, boom swings in. Filmed masterfully. However, does anyone see any issues with that closing argument? Yeah. It's the introduction. If it was just the introduction by itself, That's a brilliant introduction. And if they had added one, maybe two sentences of, my client was reduced to a permanent vegetative state because of the anesthesia that was given, that would have connected the dots. Like, you just need, it was so close, but they missed. It's beautiful, and if I could do a closing like that, I would love to, but I would want to connect the dots so the jurors understand. It's also kind of a reverse jury nullification argument, because from the plaintiff point of view of, you're the law, be just. Like, those are good themes, but you can't say, hey, go nail them. That's problematic. Anyone else see problems on the civil side with this closing?
Rachel's looking at me like...
Yeah, it's a bummer because the facts support him. So he didn't need to do that, but maybe it wasn't traumatic, they felt. Maybe it wasn't written. All the other lawyer issues in it is great. The villainous attorney's Captain Nemo. I mean, it's a wonderful film. So. Yeah, it was like 78, 79. It wasn't even around
at this point. Okay, so I don't even know if any of you have heard of this show. I think it was on for one season, really? I don't know, maybe one season? Okay, so...
Where were you when... You can fill in the blank.
Okay.
A small on the playground. In a bar. On the subway. A time when someone needed help. Need your help. Need you to stand up. Did you stand up? Did you do something? Did you say something? You don't have to. You can look away. Put your head down. Cross the street. You can stay home and lock your doors. There is no law that says you have to do anything to prevent the crime. And if Jared Nash hadn't sat there eating cereal and watching the light die from Christine Campbell's eyes, then we wouldn't be here today. You don't have to help the victim, but you cannot help the perpetrator. That is what you cannot do, and that is why we're here, because that is what Mr. Nash did do. Misprison of a felon is a crime as old as this court, and it requires that the government prove four essential elements. One, that the principal committed and completed the felony alleged. Well, we know that. Brad Hargrove has pleaded guilty to murdering Christine Campbell. Two, that the defendant had full knowledge of that fact. That also is not a question. Jared Nash admitted he knew, and the defense does not contest that he knew Brad Hargrove killed Christine Campbell. Three, that the defendant failed to notify the authorities. This, too, is not a dispute. Jared Nash proudly did not notify authorities. And four, that he took an affirmative step or steps to conceal the crime of the principal. We're here on that question, and that question alone. And on that question, the evidence is clear. At the exact time Hargrove was beating Miss Campbell to death, Jared Nash turned up his music. So loud, you could hear nothing else in that building. He did this to conceal the screams of Christine Campbell. He did this to conceal this crime. Where were you when Christine Campbell was dying? Most of you were at home, asleep. Some of you may have been working or out. You didn't know. You couldn't see her. You couldn't hear her. You couldn't help her. But you can now. You are here now. and she needs you.
Okay, so, anybody see anything? Well, yes. So the one thing that he does do that no one else does is he actually puts out the elements of the crime, which is kind of nice. You're like, oh, look at that. So he, out of all of them, this is the most, I'm not going to say accurate, but the most closest to following the rules. But yes, he does do the golden rule. He also, and you guys can tell me if I'm wrong, but apparently a prosecutor cannot talk about the rights of a victim as a counterbalance to the rights of the defendant. So you can't say, like, she needs you, her family needs you to do this. I don't know. I read that from this, so I'm assuming, but you guys can tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, their role is to determine whether a crime is committed and whether the defendant committed it. It's not to bring some sort of, I mean, our client's technically the government.
There you go.
Right.
Yes. So, all right, good. All right, we've got a couple more. So, hold on. For those of us in the civil world.
Probably 110 passed 11 months ago. Probably 160. When we came here, was detected plenty of time. I was in the hospital being treated when the doctors realized that the only thing that could save my life would be a bone marrow transplant. So I got released from the hospital because my family couldn't afford to pay the bill for what they recommended. Great benefit insurance that I don't claim. If I had had a bone marrow transplant, I would have had a 90% chance of living.
I hope that you are astonished, as I am, at the lengths to which a wealthy insurance company like the defendant will go to take money from a low-income family and then keep it by denying a legitimate claim. It's no wonder they spend so much money on their lawyers, their lobbyists, and their public relations machine to convince us we need tort reform, that we need to put an end to punitive damages. I'm asking you, the jury, just do what you think is right in your heart. If you don't punish great benefit, you'd be their next victim.
So dramatic. Okay, anybody see anything wrong with this one? Yes.
There's no law and there's no facts.
Yes.
Just an emotional deal.
It is, and they do use the day in the life. Now, obviously, as I said before, we're seeing this in a vacuum, so you have no idea if his testimony, because I know the plaintiff was actually dead by the time the trial came around, so I don't know if they brought in his testimony earlier or if they're just showing day in the life.
We'll talk about that in a moment.
So. Yeah, but they're also, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Was the testimony, the video, even though they admitted it, as they marked it as an exhibit during the trial, did it actually come in?
Yeah.
Because if not, now you're using unadmitted
exactly.
evidence in your...
Exactly. And they're also, and as an employee of an insurance company, Allstate Insurance, I am offended about their insurance comments that shouldn't come in anyway. They should have been stricken from a motion in limine. But they're also referring to a party's wealth. So you can't do that unless it's relevant for punitive damages. Specifically, now in this case, they are talking about punitive damages. So the send the message argument that he's making is allowed where it's directed towards punitive damages for a non-damage issue like finding of negligence. So because it's against the insurance company for failing to cover him, it's okay, but normally the send a message to the insurance companies for tort reform and all that stuff, no, you can't do that. Also, it's inflaming the passion of the prejudice of the jury by, like, showing that alone. And so, okay, next one. You're going to all, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we'll talk about the rules for video depots now and how they come in.
Okay, so you're all going to remember this one.
So.
Or the remake.
Our Code of Civil Procedure lists all the requirements in order for a video depot like this to come in. First off, if you have somebody on the stand, it can come in for impeachment, and let me just say, that can be super magical if you ever get to do that. Next up would be the witness is really unavailable, like dead. It can come in then. But next up is if you open the door with the way testimony is used, like one side brings in a video clip, the other side can do the same. And there's, we'll talk about, it's a broader subject on how to use video depots in trial, but just to give you a tease of it, let's keep going.
Well, I'm pretty sure the insurance company didn't bring it in.
No. So here are the rules on how to bring in video deposition testimony. You have to notify the opposing party. They have to, they can of course fight it if they want to. There has to be, again, any objection should be in writing, and it can be limited, of course, because, you know, that is required. So let's keep going. And because there's a part two to this, parts can be suppressed. The entire depot has to be offered as, in evidence. Maybe that happened in this case. If you had a client who died and you had a video depot, I'm pretty sure it would be malpractice to not offer that as evidence in the case. So you go through the checklist. The code is good for that in explaining what you can and can't do and the notice requirements and objections. Now, if you start using video clips, I was trained early in my career how to prepare video depots. It's an art. I enjoy it a lot, but you have to give context. You can't just have like one question and answer. You have to, maybe it's the question before and the question after that paints the picture of what went on. So there are different strategies to use that, but all of that gets disclosed as exhibits. You can build your clips for trial. There's lots of great products on the market. There's some that even work on the iPad very effectively. So this used to be really expensive, say in the late 1990s. Now it's very affordable, but there are expert consultants who come in to do this, and lots of good ones.
Okay. You guys will all remember this one.
Because it's real.
At the outset, let me say that not one bit of domestic violence is tolerable. O.J. Simpson is not proud of some of the things that happened during his marriage. Does that add up to murder? No. Mr. Durham talked about 1985, but he missed the whole point. Something interesting happened in 1985. Mark Firm responded to a call on Rocky. He saw a white woman married to a powerful black man. He didn't like that. He didn't like that. Because he's a hardened racist. Mark Firm is the one who said, if I see an interracial couple, I'm going to stop them. If I don't have a reason, I'm going to make something up. So you have a lying Mark Firm, the personification of evil, who found the gloves. But don't be fooled. This isn't just one officer. Mark Furman represents the entire LAPD. Now, you may not know this, but you are empowered. Your decision has a major implication both in this courtroom and outside of it. Things happen for a reason in life. Maybe that's why we're gathered together. Something in your background, your character, helps you to know that this is wrong. Maybe you're the right people at the right time to be able to say, no, we can't have this. What they have done is disgraceful. O.J. Simpson is entitled to an acquittal. They have entrusted this case to a man who says he'd like to see all niggers gathered together and killed. That is genocide. That man speaks like Adolf Hitler. Now, since you can't trust the man and you don't trust the people, is it any wonder in the defining moment in this trial when they asked O.J. Simpson to try on the glove, and the glove didn't fit. It didn't fit because it wasn't his. If you don't stop this cover-up, who will? Send them a message. Let them know that your verdict will travel far outside these walls. Ladies and gentlemen, remember these words. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Okay, I think we all remember that one. Not necessarily the reenactment from American Crime Story, but so anybody have any issues with that one? Anybody? He even says it in his closing. He says, send a message. He also has some personal opinions on Mark Furman. He calls him the personification of evil and Adolf Hitler. So maybe not that. He also says that Mark Furman is the representation of the entire LAPD, which you really can't, you shouldn't do. And he's definitely inflaming the passions and the prejudice of the jury, and he's using the golden rule. So I'm trying to go through these really fast because we are at 57 minutes, so I'm trying to get through our last two clips very fast.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've heard a lot here today, and I'm not going to try to go back over it all again for you. But you have to go back in that room and make some decisions. And there is one thing I want to make very, very clear to you before you do. I am not trying to convince you that you should like what Larry Flint does. I don't like what Larry Flint does. But what I do like is that I live in a country where you and I can make that decision for ourselves. I like that I live in a country where I can pick up Hustler magazine and read it if I want to, or throw it in the garbage can if that's where I think it belongs. Or better yet, I can exercise my opinion and not buy it. I like that I have that right. I care about it. And you should care about it too. You really should. Because we live in a free country. You know, we say that a lot, but I think sometimes we forget really what that means. So listen to it again. We live in a free country. And that is a powerful idea. That's a magnificent way to live. But there is a price for that freedom, which is that sometimes we have to tolerate things that we don't necessarily like. So go back in that room where you are free to think whatever you want to think about Larry Flint and Hustler Magazine. But then ask yourselves if you want to make that decision for the rest of us. Because the freedom that everyone in this room enjoys is in a very real way in your hands. And if we start throwing up walls against what some of us think is obscene, we may very well wake up one morning and realize that walls have been thrown up in all kinds of places that we never expected. And we can't see anything or do anything. And that's not freedom. That is not freedom. So be careful. Thank you.
Okay, anybody see any issues? Okay.
Is the judge Larry Flint?
It is Larry Flint. right after this is when the jury comes back against him and he starts throwing oranges at the judge. So yeah, it's okay. So we'll go on to the next one, and Josh will take it. It's I'm sure everyone has seen this.
To begin with, this case should never have come to trial. The state has not produced one iota of medical evidence that the crime Tom Robinson is charged with ever took place. It has relied instead upon the testimony of two witnesses whose evidence has not only been called into serious question on cross-examination, but has been flatly contradicted by the defendant. There is circumstantial evidence to indicate that Mayella Ewell was beaten savagely by someone who lived almost exclusively with his left. And Tom Robinson now sits before you, having taken the oath that the only good hand he possesses is right.
Do not need to point out to you.
so, a quiet, humble, respectable Negro, who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman, has had to put his word against two white people. The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal. I'm no idealist to believe firmly in the integrity of our courts and our jury system. That's no ideal to me. That is a living, working reality. I am confident that you gentlemen will review without passion the evidence that you have heard, come to a decision, and restore this man to his family.
Gregory Peck did that in one take. From a filmmaking standpoint, that's amazing.
So, oh, I'm sorry.
Any issues with the closing?
Anybody? 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 Okay, so I'm going to do it really fast. Out of all the research I did, The Time to Kill and To Kill a Mockingbird are the top two closing arguments in pop culture by far. They are on everybody's top. They're one and two, back and forth on everybody's list. But the main thing, and it came out in an article in February of 2019, poor Atticus. He completely violates Rule 3.4 of the model rules, saying that prohibiting the introduction of trial lawyers' personal opinions. Because he says this, he argues during closing, I have nothing but pity in my heart for the chief witness for the state, but my pity does not extend so far as putting a man's life at stake. So he completely violates the rule, even though he's like, this closing argument is number one or number two on everybody's top lists of closing arguments, he still violates the rules. So.
Yeah.
What if he changed it to we all people?
That would be different. He can't put his own personal opinions, but yeah, if he did, we all feel. But who's we all?
It is easy to feel pity for the witness.
Someone could.
Yeah. That's only a couple slight tweaks to it, because he goes after the credibility of witnesses, he talks about issues of law, it's a very effective closing. The language in it's uncomfortable because of the time that it was written, but it's still one of my favorites. Thank you.